Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
Hi everyone, just like to let you know that we are joined today by the wonderful Amy Gledhill. Now, even if you're a fairly new listener to No Such Thing as a Fish, you will know Amy because it's not that long ago since she came on. But we don't have many more weeks before Anna comes back, and we thought, who do we want back? Who do we want back on the show? Who do we enjoy the show so much with that we just can't wait to get them back on? And of all the people who fit that bill, Amy was the one who we wanted most. So we messaged her. She's very busy at the moment, but she said yes. Why is she so busy? Well, she has just been on Last One Laughing UK, the second series of that. It is so funny. It's one of the best TV moments of the year so far, and Amy is in that. She is also in the new series of Taskmaster. I know loads of you who listen to this show love Taskmaster, so you will see Amy on that show. But she also has her own podcast. She does her podcast called Northern News with former Fish alumnus Ian Smith, and she also does another podcast called Single Ladies in Your Area. Both of these podcasts are absolutely amazing. I have been on the Northern News one. It's such fun. Those two are so funny. Oh my goodness, they are so funny. Definitely go and check those out wherever you get your podcasts. They're also on Patreon, just like another podcast you might have heard of called No Such Thing as a Fish. Yes, we are on Patreon. I was just trying to find a new, different way of announcing that. But if you go to patreon.com/clubfish, then you can sign up there. When you sign up, you'll get loads of free stuff. There's plenty of stuff there for anyone who doesn't want to pay. But if you would like to give us a few pounds each month, then there are various different tiers where you can get various different things. The first one is Plenty More Fish, where you get Drop Us a Line, which is our audience feedback show and so much fun. And also you get ad-free episodes, which I know for a lot of you is a big old pull. So please do that. But mostly if you do that, you are supporting the podcast. But actually, you're supporting the podcast by being here and listening to this show with the incredible, amazing, infectiously funny Amy Gledhill. On with the podcast.
Hello and welcome to another episode of No Such Thing as a Fish, a weekly podcast coming to you from the QI offices in Holborn. My name is Dan Schreiber. I am sitting here with James Harkin, Andrew Hunter Murray, and Amy Gledhill. And once again, we have gathered around the microphones with our four favorite facts from the last 7 days. And in no particular order, here we go. Starting with fact number one, and that is Amy.
Okay, so my fact this week is, according to science, one of the best ways to avoid laughing is to think about wallpaper. Okay. This fact comes to me slightly too late. I wish I'd have discovered this fact about a year ago, really.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. All right. Yeah, so for context, you recently starred on Last One Laughing, the TV show where you have to try and survive the entire process of the show by not laughing.
Yeah.
And you were on with people like David Mitchell and Sam Campbell.
Yeah, it was hell.
So the question hell. To you, if yeah. this is a scientific method, yeah. did you have your own method?
I did, actually, yeah. Less scientific. There was lots of snacks in the room. And I thought if my mouth was always full of flumps, marshmallows,
can't laugh.
You can't laugh.
Yeah.
That's
but that isn't science, it turns out. Yeah, but I think it is. I think it did help. If you've got a mouthful of something, you're less inclined to fall.
I don't think they showed you having flumps. Yeah. Flumps are a funny food as well. Yeah. They're quite a risky food.
That's quite a kind editor, I think, who doesn't show you a mouthful of flumps.
Oh, they weren't imaginary flumps. They were real flumps.
Real flumps.
Imaginary flumps.
What's that, Dan?
Is that what you give your kids at Easter?
Yeah. The imaginary Easter eggs are in the garden. Oh, look at that massive one. No, I thought, because part of the wallpaper idea is a distraction tool. So whatever
Are you imagining wallpaper?
Exactly.
Are you really looking at it?
No, you're really looking at wallpaper, but it's a distraction tool. Therefore, if you were imagining flumps in your mouth and fitting, oh, I could fit more in, you might distract yourself.
Feels whimsical, yeah.
Well,
yeah, it feels like, not to criticize your technique, Amy, but I don't know how helpful it would be. Are you stopping laughs getting in? No, you're stopping them getting out.
Oh, yeah.
So the laughter comes from within, I suppose.
Yes. Oh, that's true.
So you mean once you swallowed the flump, then the laughter's going to come out?
Well, just...
it doesn't cork it, is what you're saying.
Yeah. It's I just can't quite... Yeah.
So I read this study, and it is distractions one of the things, right? Mm-hmm. Another one is kind of trying to control your facial muscles, which we did see on the show.
Yeah.
Mel.
Poor old Mel.
She liked to do that, didn't she?
She was gurning like it was the 90s. she had this like lower jaw protrusion, I guess, like an underbite. Mm. She'd give herself an underbite, but it was so effective.
Yeah.
So she was really like pulling them muscles in her jaw, but then it turns out, and she has said this in the press, she's had to go and see a specialist for a jaw injury.
That's funny. Is gurning, is that a drug thing?
Yes.
So no, I'm told.
No further questions. Right.
And then one other thing that they said is good for it is to reappraise the jokes in a non-funny manner, which I think is a kind of David Mitchell-y thing, isn't it?
Yeah. But I think that's quite difficult because I think to reappraise a joke, you have to understand why it's funny. So then you're thinking, gosh, that's funny for these reasons.
Yes, that's
how do we make it less funny? And I think that's a risky strategy.
And there are surprise jokes are the most dangerous of all if you're trying not to laugh.
Yes.
As in, there is a moment for international listeners, Last Word Laughing UK, go and see it. It's terrific. There's a moment where Alan Carr gets out a sausage machine and it starts firing out high-speed sausage. And there's almost no way to immediately reappraise that as a serious malfunction of a sausage machine. You think, oh dear, maybe they haven't greased that properly. It's really hard.
I think, on the other hand, you can think, oh no, he's going to lose all that sausage.
Yeah.
How you reappraise it, right? You
think, oh,
you've got to be fast.
No, you've got to reappraise it on the opening before it gets to the punch, right? So, okay, Englishman, Irishman, and Scottishman walk into a bar. You think, oh, what's the likelihood that those three were, so you don't even listen to the rest, you distract yourself with that. You think, this guy doesn't make sausages, how the hell does Alan Carr know what's about to
is it safe?
He's not a certified butcher.
There we go. I'm not laughing.
Most laughter in conversation happens after banal comments, not funny ones.
Is this your experience, Andy?
My experience, yeah.
Well, last time I came on, I did laugh a lot,
right?
what is it out of
it's not to do with whether it's funny or not, it's just kind of social grease, and also the person talking laughs more than the people they're talking to in almost every conversation. It's by more than about half, or
really?
Half as much more, and obviously it would be different in a professional comedy scenario, I guess.
But what's difficult is when the trickiest thing in that program is the conversations. You know, when someone's on the stage doing their joker, you've got flumps in your mouth, you're ready.
Oh, yeah.
But it's the little conversations that are really difficult because it's surprising.
Yeah.
And Bob Mortimer is lovely, and I told him that I was nervous about doing it. And he said the first half an hour is the hardest, because when that buzzer goes off, you get all this giddy energy and you're almost ready to laugh because you just told you shouldn't. You're almost ready to laugh anyway. So when the buzzer goes off, he came over to me to have like a neutral conversation to help me. But because you're in this prime situation and Bob Mortimer is sat, you know, a metre away from your face, and he was just trying to be nice, but it was so hard. He sat down, Amy, are you happy with your Hoover? And I was like, oh my God! Oh! Why is that the funniest thing I've ever heard?
You know, you might have had a competitive advantage in there, according to the University of Buffalo. Because, according to the history of comedy professor there, Andrew Scott, redheads are seen as funnier generally than most other people.
Interesting.
Diane Morgan, is she red as well?
Yeah.
So you two would have had competitive advantage. This is all culturally brought on to us by circus clowns, basically.
Okay.
Clowns always had big red wigs, largely so they could be seen from any bit of the circus tent. If you're sitting at the back, you'd know it's the clown.
Is
because
it also
of the red
true
hair.
That people with red noses and big feet are also seen as funnier?
Probably, yeah.
I don't know. If that's what we're saying, that the clown is...
Yes. Is this regionally... Oh, yeah. Has this been stress tested in Scotland and Ireland, which have many more people with red hair? Like, what do clowns wear? Yeah. Like, the clowns come back and died again. Just nothing I got from them.
That's true. This is Buffalo. Yeah. Okay, so, Last One Laughing US, you might have the advantage. That's a really good point. Okay. That's what my strategy would have buckled immediately as I walked in with my dyed red hair.
Wow.
They've looked at laughter and then fed it into a computer to see what kind of laughter there is. Yeah. This is how you analyze comedy. You work out what's funny. Mm. This is at the University of Amsterdam, and they found that there's two different types of laughter. So a computer can tell the difference between tickle laughter and every other kind of laughter.
Wow.
And all the other laughter, if you're watching a sitcom or you're watching stand-up or you're with your mates or whatever, they're all the same, but tickle laughter is completely different. And the algorithm can tell the difference.
Is it more panicked?
I guess so. More panty, maybe? Like,
yeah.
Panty's a funny word.
That's interesting. Because there is fear. When you're being tickled, there is fear.
There's fear. Pure fear.
Oh, yeah. We had a tickle truce in my house between me and my older son, Wilf.
Tickle truce.
A literal tickle truce. He can't tickle me because the pain is so great for me and I'm not allowed
He's
to tickle
him.
He's
doing it wrong.
Yeah. What's he doing it with? I find it so unbelievably painful. Well, actually, try. That didn't tickle me that time. James is tickling me, by the way, everyone.
I think I got a splinter.
But then I can't tickle Wilf because it happened ages ago, but I tickled him and he went, "Oh, daddy." And I went, "What?" And he went, "You tickled the wee out of me." And he pisses himself every time I tickle him. So there is a tickle truce.
You once told a joke so funny that one of the children shat themselves. Didn't you? Yes. Wasn't it? Was it in the bath?
Yes.
I was in the bath, which is not a good place for it to happen.
At least it's contained.
It's contained in a big bath.
Until you try and grab it, and then it breaks. It's like a cloning machine when you try and grab
it. What was the joke? Can you remember?
Well, don't tell it.
I want to see you on That's One Laughing and just all the other comics shitting themselves.
Wow.
Amy, your laugh is quite infectious.
Oh, thanks.
It's nice. Yeah, it's in a positive way. Okay, like, if you're laughing, people around you want to laugh, you know. Because I once caught a bad laugh from someone.
Ooh.
And I had it for
it
years.
It wasn't Jimmy, was it?
No.
No, it wasn't. It's someone you two know very well.
Was it Dan's son?
No.
If shit's coming out every time, it's a bad laugh.
Who is it?
Shouldn't have done those jacuzzi sessions, should we? That was a really was a tricky night.
Are you allowed to say?
Yeah, of course. Yeah. It was John Lloyd.
Okay.
Oh, okay.
Founder of QI.
Yeah.
Right. So he has a very distinctive laugh, which...
Ha, ha, ha.
Yes. And it's he has a bigger laugh as well for really, really
he's
funny
got
stuff.
A big laugh,
but
yeah.
even when he's like, and that's him genuinely, he's genuinely laughing.
Really?
For about 5 years once, I could only laugh like that. And I don't know how I got it.
Really? Because it is like a contagious thing and it is a social thing.
Yeah.
I think if you're copying people's laughs, that shows respect, personally.
I respect John. It's exactly that. That's probably exactly that.
So do you think people in different cultures have different laughs? Like, would you be able to tell just from a laugh if someone was like, "Oh, that person's Italian," or "Oh, that
That's
person"?
That's interesting.
You know what I mean?
Well, French. And we're getting close to the end of the socially acceptable ones to do, but let's crack on.
Wow.
But do you know what I mean? Do you think you would be able to tell?
I reckon you would.
I think you would. Yeah, maybe. You could definitely tell the difference between modern humans and old humans. Because can you guess how old humans would laugh? It wasn't a ha 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 because they couldn't make those sounds.
They couldn't make those sounds.
No, humans managed to say a ha sound quite late in our development.
Oh, wow.
So before that,
he
that still has an H in it.
Oh, okay.
Was it like the Count from Sesame Street? Ah.
He is a primitive human. Yeah.
Well, obviously we don't know, but it appears to have been more panty. And that's because, like, if you look at apes today, for instance, they have more of a panting laugh when they...
Oh, wow.
So they...
yeah, Yeah.
That was very good. You've done that before.
We have enough.
Oh, wait. Wallpaper.
Do you want to do a wallpaper thing on that?
No, it's fine. It's just I've read so much about wallpaper. Yeah. I've got pages here of wallpaper stuff.
I've got a little bit of wallpaper stuff.
Oh, okay. Yeah, right.
Okay. So with the wallpaper thing, I tried to find out what's the least funny wallpaper to add to the thing in case I ever need to not laugh again. And the least funny thing I could find about wallpaper was the Victorian wallpaper was often bright green, but it had arsenic in it.
Oh.
So a lot of it actually was quite fatal.
Oh no!
Yes.
So that's got to be the least funny.
That's not funny.
It's not funny.
No,
unless you're driven to hysteria as part of the poisoning, which sometimes happens, right?
That would happen with like mercury poisoning.
Yes,
isn't it? I'm not sure about arsenic. It's more death.
Just pure death.
More just pure death. That one.
Well, that's not fun at all.
No. I joined the. I've joined the Wallpaper History Society. As part of research for this fact.
Sure. Let's pretend you weren't already a member.
It's a good price. I pegged it to my previous membership, and it's exactly the same price as the Association of Lighthouse Keepers, which I'm also a member of.
Wow. When you meet another member of the Wallpaper Association, do you say, how's it hanging?
Yeah. Strip poker is a much more tame affair at the Wallpaper Society. No, it's good. You get a copy of the Wallpaper History Review.
Okay.
Packed! With over 100 pages of wallpaper and wall covering related information.
That's good.
You get priority booking on some Wallpaper History Society events.
Okay.
Priority
that's
booking.
Useful,
how many times have we got to the front?
Yeah.
Sorry, sir. £25.
For the year? That's not bad, is it?
It's not bad.
It's not bad. You could spend it on worse.
Yeah.
I can't think of anything.
Okay, it is time for fact number two, and that is my fact. My fact this week is that until 1960, American cinemagoers watched movies in no particular order. So this is...
Like Memento? That's in no particular... Well, that's actually in a particular order. It's just backwards, isn't it?
It's just backwards.
But any Christopher Nolan film.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's something going on there with time. You know.
Tenet is in both particular orders.
Exactly. The most radical thing Christopher Nolan could do now would just be to release a film that starts at the beginning, gets through the middle, gets to the end. We've got a grudge going, but me and him, Amy, we don't need to get into it.
No, I get it. I thought Tenet was one of the only films I nearly walked out of the cinema.
Really?
Yeah. I think I got really obsessed because they just kept saying the word algorithm. For no reason, and being really smug about it. They just had algorithms so much that it started becoming funny, and I was like, I've got to leave. I can't be laughing at the word algorithm. I've got to go.
Note to anyone for series 3 if Amy returns.
I can imagine Bob Mortimer walks in. So, Amy, what's your favourite algorithm?
Flops, 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 flops.
Wallpaper, wallpaper, wallpaper.
This is an amazing little detail about American cinema, which is prior to 1960, movies in the cinema were just on a loop. And so you might arrive at the end of the movie, you might arrive in the middle of the movie, and you would often, if you enjoyed the end of it, you would stay and watch the beginning of the movie.
Yeah.
And they used to know if a movie was going to be hit, if people got to the bit they'd already seen and wanted to watch it again because they enjoyed it so much.
It's like if you go to an art gallery and they show movies, they're like that, aren't they?
Yeah. Yes, exactly. Yeah.
And they would have double bills too.
They'd
so you'd have
bills.
One film, then you'd have another whole film, then you'd have the first half of the film.
Or some news reels
as well. But it was on a loop, and so this was the culture of movie going in America. And it was really frustrating for a lot of filmmakers. They desperately tried to say, get there at the start, because it has a plot that works really nicely when you see it in the order we've made it. Exactly. So what changed this all was in 1960, Alfred Hitchcock released Psycho. He made it his big campaign. You have to see Psycho at this starting time and watch it till the end. And there were posters everywhere. There were adverts in movie cinemas. There were sort of cardboard cutouts all saying the same thing.
He basically said, if you don't turn up on time, you're not coming in.
Yeah.
Like going to the theatre, I guess.
Yes. Exactly.
And one of the posters is him, and he's just pointing at his watch, and you think, oh, that looks like a fun night.
That's like Andy if you come here 1 minute late. He gets his watch out.
Yeah.
I'm the visionary auteur of No Such Thing as a Fish, I guess is what James is trying to say.
I think what was happening is it was kind of a shift that was happening, right?
Yeah.
So especially if you were in a big city, if you're in New York or something, they would show one-off films. Like Gone with the Wind was often shown as a one-off film.
Okay.
I think Ben-Hur was as well.
Because longer and epic? And
yeah,
so,
and okay. So you go as an event.
Right.
But it, especially in the smaller towns and also just more generally, it was exactly as you suggest. But then Psycho was like, it was like a moment where they were like, okay, they're all going to be like this now.
Yeah,
but right. I think lots of other people had tried it and it hadn't taken off. So various people had attempted it before Hitchcock. Like there was a one film exhibitor in 1937 said, there should be a nationwide go to the show on time campaign, which didn't do any good. There was a 1945 film, I love this, called Mildred Pierce, right? And they ran an early campaign which said, I'm quoting here, due to the sensational surprise twist in the ending of Mildred Pierce, positively no patron will be seated in the theatre during the last 8 minutes of this picture.
Wow.
It's like 110 minutes long. So you can get it at any point in the first like hour and 10 or whatever.
It's not like the Americans to turn up late in the 1940s, is it?
Brilliant. Brilliant.
Nice little bit of satire
there.
You told them.
But yeah, so this was completely altered by Psycho, a movie which already altered cinema in so many ways. The soundtrack was a big moment in that movie, that kind of stabbing, that's Jaws.
Is that Jimmy Carr laughing again?
Yeah. Quick cutting. There were so many innovative bits of that. But what's often not said is basically Americans go to see the movie on time now because of it.
Mm. That's incredible. What number film of Hitchcock's was Psycho? It's not his first film.
No,
is it?
Not his first.
Not, so, I don't know.
So he's had films in the cinemas and people are just going, oh, it's a lot of birds.
Oh, yeah. He had a really long career. He started in black and white and then made the shift to colour. And 1960, right. I guess, was a bit of a bit more of a marginal case because there were plenty of colour films by then, and all of his later ones obviously are colour. But
interesting. Yeah. And then the difference being in Britain, like we still had this as well, where you would do the kind of the shorts and the news and stuff, and you could come in at any time. But it was much less common. And in British cinemas, you would often have an usher, and you would turn up, and the usher would take you to your seat in time because it was based on the old theatres.
Right.
That's nice.
Yeah. Mm. That is nice.
Would you still like that?
I wouldn't mind it. Yeah. I went to the cinema recently and it's basically become now a food and drink venue, which where there's a film on as well. So there's a lot of people coming and going and
Like where you can get like pizzas and stuff.
It was a posh, my local was quite a posh cinema. Oh, so they'll do you know, it brings things to your seat.
Oh yeah. I had a cheese board at Killers of the Flower Moon.
You've changed, Amy.
Cheese board.
I had a cheese board. I thought, this shouldn't be allowed.
That's amazing.
You scan the thing and then you press what you want. People bring you cocktails and burgers and...
Yeah.
God. Yeah,
it's a nice quiet,
Hitchcock wouldn't have liked it.
It's quiet food though, relatively quiet at cheese board.
Yes.
Psycho also basically came out largely because Hitchcock was inspired by another low budget horror film, which was called House on Haunted Hill, made by a guy called William Castle. And Castle was brilliant at creating gimmicks. So really what Alfred Hitchcock was doing was a big old gimmick. He was turning it into an event. He was making press off the back of this point that he was pushing. And William Castle was sort of the king of doing it. He used to do things like saying this movie might scare you to death. So he took out mock insurance policies and he would put newspaper ads showing them. They'd even have replicas of the policies sort of a poster size outside of the venues, and they would have hearses waiting outside so that you really got a sense of what was going on.
At the House on Haunted Hill you were talking about?
Yeah.
He would have a fright break in the middle of it. And at that stage, anyone was allowed to go into the lobby and sit in a place called Coward's Corner until they were ready to come back.
That's right. Yeah. And he also had, it was very expensive, it would seem, in all these local theatres. He had a thing installed that was called the Percepto, which was for his movie The Tingler, it was a little buzzer that was added to all the chairs that electrified it slightly. So at various moments during the movie, at a scary moment, you'd feel a literal in your chair. And he would have skeletons that would fly out at certain moments. It was all very creative stuff.
He always wanted to be a proper filmmaker. I mean, he was a proper filmmaker. Like, horror movies are a proper genre, but he wanted to make more respectable films. He produced Rosemary's Baby. And he wanted to direct it, but then Polanski did it instead. And his daughter later on said that when they had dinner every night, instead of saying grace, he would practice his Oscars acceptance speech.
Oh my goodness.
That's wonderful. What, no one else does that? Come on, we'll do it. Every night, same time.
Let us thank Harvey Weinstein.
I practice my speech to the annual dinner of the Wallpaper History Society.
You know, the point you were making about William Castle not directing Rosemary's Baby?
Oh, yeah.
It's because he was directing these kind of slasher B movies, and they thought no one's going to take it seriously. And that happens quite a few times when it comes to making movies. So, for example, Mel Brooks was the producer of The Elephant Man, but they took his name off the credits. He asked to, because he was like, everyone will be laughing when they see that I'm associated with it.
Do you know what that's like when Steve Coogan came out to play Jimmy Savile? And initially I was like, oh, come on. You can't. He did impressions of him. That no one's going to take that seriously. But it was fantastic.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. Mm. Did you not see it?
No, I didn't
see it.
Oh, I've not just made that up, have I?
No. Oh, my God.
Well, we've had Weinstein. We've had Savile.
Yeah.
Who else is going to make it into this chat?
Polanski.
Hull's Cecil Theatre. You're from Hull?
I'm from Hull, yeah.
Do you know the Cecil Theatre?
I think it's a bingo hall now.
Ah, well, it used to be a cinema.
Wow.
But it used to come with a noted orchestra.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, wow.
Of seven, but still.
That's not bad.
Instruments and vocalists. And you used to get, just cinema used to be such a fancier experience in lots of ways. And, you know, you see sometimes cinemas now which have incredible architecture. Yeah. And you think, gosh, this was really, this was really fancy.
Yeah, there's a Wetherspoons on Holloway Road that used to be a cinema, and it's this beautiful, absolutely stunning building, and you go inside and it's gorgeous, but now it's just, you know, WKD Blues, which I love.
Yeah.
So out of curiosity, how far was it to the toilets from your table?
Oh, yeah, it's like a sponsored walk.
I told you that we've mentioned this before, the toilets are always miles away in Wetherspoons.
Yeah.
You know where that would be useful? Did you any of you watch the Long Walk film from last year?
Stephen King adapted, right?
Yeah.
No.
So it's about these guys who, it's like a dystopian America, if you can imagine such a thing. And you get one or two people from each state, and they have to walk, and they have to keep their speed above 4 miles an hour. And if they drop, then they get shot.
Whoa, gosh.
Is there someone near them with a gun?
The US Army people are doing it.
Why are they doing it?
I can't. It's a bit of a Hunger Games-y thing, I think.
Yeah.
I can't really remember.
But it's just walking at 4 miles an hour.
Yeah.
Yeah, but like eventually you're going to run out of energy.
Yeah, definitely. But I'm just trying to work out is it fun for people to watch this?
It's good. It's a good film. I liked it anyway.
No, I mean the entertainment. Sorry, in the world of the film, are people watching this for entertainment?
People like stand on the side of the streets like it's the Tour de France.
Yeah.
Wow.
Are they all walking at the same? They're all together. You said one person from each state. I was imagining this is happening in 50 separate locations everywhere.
No, sorry. Yeah, they all come to one place to do it.
Wow. I understand. Okay.
Anyway, there is a real one that happens in Sweden. And it's been going since 2009. And they don't get shot in this one. You're just out. But you have to keep your walk above 4 miles an hour. And it's based on the Stephen King book.
No way.
4 miles an hour is a bit of a trot.
It's not too bad. Like it's a fair pace, but it's not. You definitely wouldn't have to run it.
Okay.
And how long are people lasting?
Well, the first one in 2009, it lasted only 10 hours, but people have suddenly got really good at it. And the last one, or the longest one in the last couple of years, was 87 hours and 48 minutes.
Wow!
What are you doing? What are you doing for the facilities during that time?
You have to go. In the movie, you just have to go.
While you're walking?
Yeah, you get like yellow cards and
makes
stuff.
Makes sense.
Not for
like
me.
A bit like last Not one. Laughing, you get yellow cards.
You do.
But yeah, you have to go. And like...
What?
I think you're allowed to sort of slow down, but then you have to make it back up. So you can quickly get down and do it and then sort of run slightly and then you'll catch up.
What about washing your hands?
Maybe wet wipes.
Wow.
When it's sporting, you just go in your pants. That's what it is. I saw an interview with Alex.
Sorry. We'll come back to that. Carry on.
Weirdly, I want to know where this is going. Weirdly, saw an interview with Alex Ferguson.
Alex Honnold.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
The guy who free soloed, who we spoke about.
The amazing, amazing climber. Person.
Yeah, and he was asked that question. What do you do if you need a piss or have a shit? And he said, you just do it.
Yeah, but he's 1,000 meters up from the consequences, isn't he? They cut that out of the movie, didn't they?
Did he climb up the building quite recently or something?
Yes, he did. The Taiwan Tower.
Yeah.
God,
100 floors.
Stood at the bottom of that tower.
No.
How interesting. I've not made the connection before, but Stephen King wrote The Long Walk,
yep.
made into the movie, and he also wrote The Running Man.
The Running Man, yeah.
Which was made yeah. into a movie recently yeah. as well. So he's yeah. doing all
I
levels
mean, he
of...
does write a lot of old rubbish, doesn't he? Like, I do like some of his stuff, but it's like, oh, let's make a horror film about a cup
yeah.
That's yeah. haunted. And then,
the jogging lad.
I think he wrote The Running Man in 3 days after a 90s gurning binge.
Did he?
Yeah. He's written whole novels where he doesn't remember writing them because of the drugs he was doing.
Really?
Yeah.
I think Long Walk was a short story as well.
It was it was a novel, but it was short. Novella, like right? novella, yeah. yeah. Yeah, exactly.
That's funny.
Is that funny?
Well, it's long, but it's short.
It's funny.
Yeah.
Carry on.
Tell me about these laughs that come after banal comments again.
Okay, it is time for fact number 3, and that is Andy.
My fact is, the first Earl of Bristol spent £17,000 a year on hot chocolate.
Oh. Wow.
Is that modern money?
Yeah.
Or, okay.
I hope he got marshmallows and whipped cream for that as well.
But I started thinking about it. I think, you know, if you go to a cafe every day, it adds up, doesn't it?
How much would you spend per day? 365. So let's say, 3,017 threes, 50 quid.
A day?
Yeah.
Okay, it's a bit more than that. It's a bit more than that. Yeah. But I think he might have had to spend it on his own chocolatier. And it might have included staffing costs as well as...
Okay.
In that case, that's not even minimum wage.
No, minimum wage is a more recent innovation. The first Earl of Bristol a while ago. And he was probably making back on the service what he spent on the chocolate. I recently went to a place called the Ickworth Rotunda, which is a great place. Is it National Trust?
It is. I've been there.
Yeah,
yeah.
It's great. Well,
what's a rotunda?
Just a round, big old round building, and it's got a couple of wings coming off the side of it. And it's a lovely place. And it was the sort of family home of the Earls of Bristol. And it was actually built for the fourth Earl, but there was an information display about the family's history. And they have
Were you looking at the wallpaper and the display saying, someone get rid of this? It's getting in the way of the wallpaper.
And they have facts about sort of the family, and they have a few of the artifacts, and they have the chocolate pot of the first Earl of Bristol.
Very
this is
cool.
how I spend my free time, Amy. And basically, it's all about, you know, we've said, I think, before that hot chocolate was basically an aristocrat's thing. It was so difficult to get hold of, you know, growing cocoa, refining it, making it actually pleasant to drink. And so the really wealthy people would have their own chocolatier, mostly royals. Hampton Court Palace has its own chocolate kitchen.
Wow.
And when that happened, fashionable Londoners started getting their own chocolate kitchens installed. Like, that was the home improvement to have in the 18th century.
That's like the air fryer of its day.
It basically was, yeah.
Wow.
And you'd have to have a servant in there whose job was just to prepare the chocolate.
That's really cool.
Because it was such a process. You needed to get the beans, roast the beans, prepare the cake, as it were, of pressed bean paste, and then shave it in the right way, and then like stir it constantly. It was such a production to make it. And so obviously it was the wealthy who were having it.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's very cool. This, I'm just having a memory of Ickworth now, which is the family who had it, the Earl of Bristol's descendants, basically lost it from bad investments and so on. They're the Herveys, like Lady Victoria Hervey.
Yeah. All that lot.
Yeah. And on the walls there, in front of that delicious wallpaper, is the story of basically of how they squandered all of their good fortune.
It's a display of like these people screwed it up.
Yeah. What did they do? Gambling?
It was gambling. It was drinking. It was massive parties where everyone got like 6 bottles of champagne. It was just like, it's incredible seeing that. Like, you're like, this person was born to a huge amount of money and died skint. And just like, it just time after time, these people
that's
doing
actually,
it.
To me, that's really nice to hear.
Yeah.
You know what? I was reading a while ago about these card games became really popular, didn't they? Like Faro and stuff. And all of these really wealthy people lost their entire family fortunes. Yeah. And then the people who got it were like the rough and ready people who were like a bit smart and a bit. I love those stories.
I think they were a bit out of touch. Lady Victoria Hervey, in 2003, she was quoted in The Guardian as a roundup for 2003's greatest sayings as saying, "It's so bad being homeless in winter. They should go somewhere warm like the Caribbean where they can eat fresh fish all day."
Good God. Wow-y. That can't be real. That can't be real.
It was in The Guardian, yeah. So don't sue if it's not Lady Victoria. She's very busy at the moment defending Prince Andrew on TV at the moment. So she's too busy to listen to podcasts.
He goes to the Caribbean a lot, doesn't he?
Oh, God.
I heard.
Can probably I tell fresh you?
Weinstein, Saville, Polanski. This is like pedo Pokemon we're playing today. It's not good.
I wish they would fucking catch them all.
Yeah.
Lovely.
Can I tell you about the most expensive hot chocolate in the world?
Yeah.
Do you want to guess how much it costs for one cup?
One cup.
It's in New York.
It's in New York.
30 quid. $50.
I'll say $200.
Okay.
$200. Okay. Yeah. So we've got quid and dollars. I'm going to go for 300 Australian.
How many yen is that?
Is that 60 quid?
With the exchange rate, it's hard to tell.
I can't remember the exchange rate with Aussie.
Well, you're all way off.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. No. 25,000 US dollars.
Impossible.
Oh, no, it's true.
What?
So this is a restaurant in New York called Serendipity 3, and it features 28 rare cocos, 5 grams of 24-carat edible gold, edible diamonds, and is served in a gold-encrusted goblet with a diamond-studded spoon, which you get to keep afterwards.
Oh.
But if you want to order it, you have to give them like 2 weeks' notice for them to source all of the ingredients and everything. $25,000.
Like a beef Wellington's often like that, isn't it? You have to book it in advance.
That's exactly the same, yeah. I think that's exactly the same.
Are you on the blower to your local carvery? The diamonds are edible, aren't they?
So is that,
I'm sorry, edible diamond. Yeah, I want to get into that? This. Like,
yeah.
What
are you collecting it at home on the other side?
Oh.
What do you mean?
Well, you're eating the precious stuff, right?
Yeah.
So are you passing it on the other side?
In the bath.
But edible diamond.
Edible diamonds.
Yeah, amazing.
Yeah. Do you think they crunch? Do you think you like crunch the diamonds and swallow? Or do you think it's literally like... you just swallow a diamond. Is anything edible if you can swallow it?
Great question. Is anything edible if you can swallow it? Well, if it doesn't poison you, technically it wouldn't be edible.
Well, poison's edible. It's above you.
But I guess we're saying...
I'm on Amy's side here.
I guess we're saying you want to survive the process, right?
I didn't have the $25,000 to begin with. I'm going to need to die before the bill is presented.
You said, Amy, just before we started recording, you said you don't drink any hot drinks, but you do drink hot chocolate.
Yes. Yeah.
What's going on there?
I'm a freak.
Dan, some things are said off mic that should stay off mic.
We'll get in the press, guys. Chortle's going to be all over this.
This is a scoop of hot chocolate. I don't like the smell of coffee or tea, don't like the taste of it. But hot chocolate, I mean, I defy anyone to not like hot chocolate. It's chocolate and it's hot.
Yeah. That's a good point.
It's also very good for you. If you believe Captain James Wadsworth.
I do, yeah.
So 1652. So this is really nearly first contact for Britain. I think it had arrived in about 1640. But anyway, it was accessible from one place initially in London, a bookseller in Holborn, not far from here.
Oh, yeah.
Called John Dakins. And there's an early example of an advert for it in the press, and it's just text saying, you know, this cures fluxes, consumptions, coughs of the lungs, sundry other desperate diseases. It also causes conception, or it helps to cause conception.
Wow. Oh.
Hastens and facilitates birth.
Okay.
It's a good thing if you're in labor.
That is good.
And beauty gained and continued.
Very nice.
Good.
I've read another way in which it's good for saving your life, as well as good health, is there was a story in America of a lady called Patricia Borges who survived an explosion in a chocolate factory in Pennsylvania because as it exploded... You okay, Andy?
Yeah, it's just
funny. Laughing like a primitive human.
It's very panty.
It's really funny. I'm sorry to hear about this lady being in an explosion in a chocolate factory, but she must have done something to piss off Willy Wonka. So.
Well, she was in this factory and there was a big explosion and her arm caught fire and she was running away from...
Bloody hell.
Yeah, and she was burning up, but as she was running, the floor collapsed and she fell through the floor into a giant vat of hot chocolate. And so the hot chocolate put her arm out and it also allowed for her, when she went under, to avoid the big explosion that happened. And firefighters eventually found her and she survived.
Was she, because when you come out of that hot chocolate, it's going to solidify into a perfect shape of a human. That's like a perfect Easter egg, isn't it?
Yes, they wrapped her in foil after it, as you do when someone's in flames. So yeah, no, she survived.
Yeah.
There were sadly casualties, but she was one of the survivors of it. Yeah, so it can save your life.
Very good.
Hot chocolate, as in... You Sexy Thing.
Oh, the band.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
So Errol Brown.
Yep.
Lead singer. Great guy. Heck of a voice.
Oh, yeah.
Sadly dead now. Uh-huh. When he left the band in 1985, thereabouts, his band replaced him with an Errol Brown impersonator.
Oh.
That's... No way.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. Who had been on Stars in Their Eyes doing Errol Brown.
Like,
yeah,
isn't that?
Can you imagine getting that call after doing that show? You're not going to believe this.
Yeah, we're promoting you to be Errol Brown.
God, I just imagine Errol Brown watching Stars in Their Eyes the first time when this guy comes out. Yeah. Goes, oh fuck, he's good. Yeah. I am in serious trouble here.
Wow!
But there's a lovely coda to this.
Yeah,
Errol Brown himself was born in Jamaica. And where did hot chocolate initially come to Britain from? Jamaica.
Wow.
Oh, as in the drink came from Jamaica.
Sorry, yeah. Right. The confusing thing is the band and the drink are called hot chocolate. Yeah. Sorry. Chocolate, like cocoa, started in... It was when Britain basically seized Jamaica from the Spanish. That's what they gained the cocoa plantations. And as a result, that's why hot chocolate came to Britain, because previously it had been a European thing.
Okay.
So that's just that little circle closed.
Yeah.
Do you think Errol Brown knew that and that's why they called it hot chocolate?
You can't have not done.
<I'm sorry. laughs> Wow.
No, I've no idea. I've no idea why they called that.
Well, I think I think it's because he's a sexy man and his skin colour.
Right.
Maybe.
I'm pretty sure that's right.
I think it flat out is that. Yes,
is that. Okay.
It was in tribute to the shipping route of where in the 1500s.
Okay.
Oh, but there is that song, Where Did You Come From, You Sexy King?
Oh, yeah.
Jamaica. By the shipping route.
Oh, dear.
Okay, it is time for our final fact of the show, and that is James.
Okay, my fact this week is that in 1811, halfway through a big UK tour, the biggest cow in England was lost in a cockfighting bet and turned into meat.
bad gig.
But also halfway through the tour.
Yeah.
Like,
I mean,
with all the future venues have to be told. So, sadly, due to the act being eaten.
We've got a terrifically angry cockerel, if you want to see that.
Okay, so this is the Craven Heifer, And the Craven Heifer is quite familiar to me because I learned to play pool in a pub called the Craven Heifer in Bolton.
Wow.
And actually, there's quite a few pubs in the North of England called the Craven Heifer. And I didn't know what it was, but apparently it was a real cow. And it was well known as the biggest cow in the whole of England. It was 11 feet and 4 inches from nose to rump.
Wow.
It was 5'4" at the shoulder and weighed 312 stone. And it went on tour around the country as this enormous cow. And so people would pay like a shilling to see this massive cow. It was from Yorkshire. It was from Bolton Abbey, which is near like Skipton, Keighley Way. And then they brought it all the way down to Haymarket and then took it back up. It was bought by this guy called John Watkinson, who decided, well, this is going really well. I'm going to buy this now. I'm going to tour it in even bigger venues. And then he managed to lose it at a cockfight. and it got turned into meat, and he never made his money. It cost him 200 quid, which was probably a lot of money in those days.
Oh, those days, yeah.
Yeah. And the
that
Herald...
I could keep the Earl of Bristol in hot chocolate for like a week.
It was reported in the Herald as an ignominious end for the beast that once grazed within the precincts of Bolton Abbey.
It's so bad, because that's the guy who lost the bet is basically the agent of this cow, right? Can you imagine him coming back after that? And the cow's like, man, the tour is going great. We're selling out. This is awesome.
I've got a few changes for the second half. I just think,
listen, I got a bit of bad news. I lost you tonight. What?
I think the tour wasn't going well, apparently.
It was going badly. I think Watkinson was having troubles.
Yeah,
paid a lot of money for this cow. Like, people had already seen it.
Yeah,
it was just a big cow.
It's hard to ship tickets these days, you know, prices and everything.
Because it had done a tour. Did you say this to London?
Yeah, where... it's kind of done a tour around the north, then gone all the way to London, come all the way back, and then was on like a second run, which is why I say it was like halfway through the tour.
Yeah, oh, they say you only play Leeds Theatre twice, once on the way up, and once just before you're killed and eaten. Nice to be back. The first tour, I just find this really interesting. I love the Craven Heifer. It's an amazing story. The first tour ended at Smithfield Meat Market in London.
Which is a pretty dicey place to play if you're a cow.
If I was a famously big meaty cow, I would be looking at that tour route saying, so what? So we're ending there, are we?
No more shows after that? No, that's literally the last show on the tour. Right, okay.
The agent's going, listen, if I was a betting man, and I am sadly, I'd say we'll sell out.
How would a cow be transported around?
Ooh,
I think it walked some of the way.
Didn't.
I think so.
Carriages would
be carriages,
too. It was not.
You couldn't get in a carriage if it's
11
foot.
No, but you could put it on like a flat thing which a carriage would pull.
Like a sort of a trailer. So,
yeah. What year? 1811 was the trains.
No, trains weren't in business by then. No.
Right.
Good question, actually. I don't know.
So many good questions.
Yeah.
But, how do you get a cow around country? Yeah, very good question, Amy.
Next week, question time will be in Hull.
This is, I feel like the research road that I've gone down is Northern News, which is your brilliant podcast with Ian. And I was looking into other stories from early days. So Falridge in Lancashire. Have you heard of Falridge?
No.
Okay. So
I'm from Lancashire, never heard of Falridge.
Okay. Well,
there's a Falridge.
Yeah. Well, this is in 1912. There's a place there which is called the Mile Tunnel, which is more than a mile in length. Some say it's just under, so I guess they've...
Some say.
There may be rumours.
They do say that actually the tunnel be just under a mile. Just under a mile.
But they're mad.
And that is how they speak in Lancashire.
I think we nailed it.
Yeah, well done, guys.
I'm doing my foreign exchange from Somerset. So
well, anyway, the 1912, the Burnley Express reported with the headline, Extraordinary Event at Falridge. And it said...
We've measured the tunnel and it's just over a mile.
Anyway, no one had ever swum it. No one had ever swum it until 1912. Until a cow did.
Yeah. That's a twist.
And this was a very valuable cow, according to the paper called Buttercup. He jumped into...
Funny name for a paper. Go on.
So he jumped into the river.
Cows can swim.
Yeah, the cow. Yeah, cows can swim. Yeah. Yeah. Cows can, like, sometimes they get, like, I remember Ash, he used to be, he does the theme tune for our podcast. He was going between islands once on a small dinghy.
Oh, yeah.
And just in the middle between these two islands, there was just a pig swimming. Yeah. They just passed a pig.
Andy didn't ask if pigs could swim.
Yeah,
but I was just saying animals generally can swim. Yeah, I took the bigger question.
Fair enough. If you've ever seen a cow swim, better still if you have some photographs, podcast@qi.com.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Oh, that'd be cool.
Because we got a lot of people sending us evidence that chickens could fly the other day.
Yeah, that's true.
A couple of weeks ago, I foolishly queried it, and boy, was I wrong.
Okay.
Yeah. So any more about this swimming cow?
Well, they've been swimming since at least 1912, according to the Burnley Express, because it was startled by some boys, and it swam this whole tunnel, and it made it to the other side. A boat even went past it and didn't notice that it was in there. And
that's really interesting. I just looked up where it is. It's right next to Pendle Hill, which is where the witches were from.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Yes. Wow. So maybe it was a possessed cow.
The famous witches of Lancashire were from Pendle Hill.
I don't know about them.
There's not much to say about them apart from they were old ladies who lived there who were persecuted for allegedly being witches.
Oof.
It's like wallpaper.
Amy, on Northern News, is there a Northern News story that sticks out to you as especially good or bad, but memorable?
Where the first thing that popped into my head is the papers went round to someone's house because he'd reported someone just kept shouting the word porridge through his letterbox.
Is it Ronnie Barker?
And it was just doing his head in. And he just was like, "What? Who's shouting porridge through my letterbox?" And then it moved on to somebody shouting, "It's porridge time, Papa Bear." And it was a mystery. They never got to the bottom of it.
They never got to
the bottom. Never solved it. Yeah.
Is this a recent mystery?
I would say in the last couple of years.
Because it feels like we've got doorbell cameras. Like you must be able to
CCTV.
You've got to be able to set a trap for.
You must be able to.
Yeah.
I'm now invested in finding out who that was. I want to know. That's crazy.
And what a strange thing, because you know the paper was saying, "Have you got any link to porridge, or do you eat a lot of porridge?" Nothing. There was nothing. But every day, someone was shouting.
Every day.
Or at least most days, people were just shouting, "It's porridge time, Papa Bear."
That's really. As pranks go, that's kind of perfect.
Yeah.
It's like how they say the perfect murder is you should just kill a stranger on a train, and you've got no connection with them. There's nothing to link you to the crime.
You've got a ticket that you've bought.
Okay. Cancel the train. But you know, the perfect crime is just a completely random one.
Yeah,
you can never be caught for it. And maybe it's just a random person decided, "I'm going to shout porridge. It's porridge time, Papa Bear," through the door of this house every day.
That's the perfect
crime for me.
That's great.
Right. Yeah, that's a great Northern
News. Can I tell you another mystery that I found from some Northern News? This is from Newcastle upon Tyne. In 1975 in the newspapers. Actually, it's this, and if I say some more, they all came from a place called weirduniverse.com, where they go through old newspaper cuttings.
Oh, cool.
Anyway, this was a lady in Durham Marketplace who was trying to park in a parking spot, but found an impregnable force field prevented her from entering this parking spot. But the really interesting thing is then other drivers had the same problem and they couldn't, because of this force field, they couldn't get into the car parking spot. Apparently, no one seemed to have any problem walking into the space, but they just couldn't park
into cars.
It.
James, what are you talking about?
I think he's talking about Stephen King's Under the Dome, which is
The Parking Woman.
Yes.
I love that book.
This was in the newspaper, and then council officials later investigated and were able to pull into the space with no trouble.
Oh, how amazing.
Wow.
Yeah, but that always happens when you bring science into it.
Yeah. Do you know what the most northern place in the UK is?
In the UK?
The most northern point in England.
Oh, in England?
And I'm like the most northern.
In England?
I'm not. I'm saying the most northern.
Oh, I see.
Culturally.
Yeah.
I would still say it would be somewhere like, oh no, Berwick, because that's quite South Scotland, isn't it?
Yeah.
I say like Berwick. Newcastle or something.
Well, it's a village called Langton Matravers, which is just near Swanage in Dorset.
Come on.
What?
Some qualifications here.
Yeah, okay. I feel like this is going to be offensive to two members of the team.
Go on. Carry on.
In 2022, Langton Matravers became the first place in the UK ever where True North, Magnetic North and Grid North all met at the same point. Because you know how Magnetic North is moving? Mm. It's moving across.
Right.
And there's Grid North and then there's True North. So, and they're all slightly different things depending on which way you cut it, basically. But that is the first bit where they all met.
I don't think I really understand it, but that's cool.
No, fair point. Fair.
I don't know why anywhere else wouldn't have the same.
Yeah.
Because, so Grid North is the line that runs up to the North Pole on an Ordnance Survey map.
And oh, as in like the Greenwich Meridian kind of?
Kind of, yeah. And True North is something very similar to do with longitude lines. And then Magnetic North is the actual line to the Magnetic North Pole.
Yeah. Well, yeah,
and it was the first time they ever met, but it was in Dorset. So it wasn't in the north. It was just there.
Okay.
That's nice.
Yeah.
That's
and cool. It's moved since then because it's moving.
It's moved back to Yorkshire. Where it belongs.
In 1966, in June, 12-year-old Beatles superfan Carol Dryden of Sunderland decided to post herself to the Beatles.
Yes.
Oh.
Yes.
So she got into a big old box, paid the $8.47 because it was an American newspaper, which this was in the Rochester Democrat and Chronicle. So around 10 quid in postage.
Okay.
And posted herself to the Beatles, care of their fan club, London. And apparently she got as far as the railway station before a clerk noticed that the box was wobbling back and forth. She kind of got too hot because she hadn't put any air holes in the box and she was trying to take her sweater off and they noticed it was moving. And yeah, they sent her home and refunded her postage.
That's kind.
That's very kind.
That is kind.
That's nice.
Royal Mail wouldn't do that. They'd deliver you somewhere else. Out of spite. They'd deliver you to the Rolling Stones.
Yeah. We'd send your daughter home, but she's behind the bins. Yeah.
Okay, that is it. That is all of our facts. Thank you so much for listening. If you would like to get in contact with any of us about the things that we've said over the course of this podcast, we can all be found online. I'm on at Schreiberland on Instagram. James?
My Instagram is No Such Thing as James Harkin.
Andy?
At Andrew Hunter M.
And Amy?
At That Amy Gledhill.
Yes, and there is so much Amy to be watching and listening to at the moment. There's Northern News, your podcast.
Yeah.
Single Ladies in Your Area.
Yeah.
There's also Last One Laughing. You on Taskmaster?
Yeah.
My goodness.
I'm sorry. It's too much, isn't it?
That's brilliant. Where's the best place? Is it your Instagram?
Instagram. Yeah. Yes, please.
Okay. So do find Amy there. If you want to talk to us about the things that we've said over the course of this show, podcast@qi.com is the bigger place to go, because if you send us an email, you can send us your facts, which we will take and put on our bonus Monday show, which is called Little Fish. So send them there. Or if you got feedback about things that we've said on our show or experiences that you've had about things we've spoken about, please send them in to drop us a line.
Seen any good wallpaper recently?
Yeah, shat yourself. There are so many things that you could have done. And if you send them to Andy at podcast@qi.com, he will pick them out for Jewel, which is Drop Us a Line, which is our special mailbag episode. Now, that's a sort of secret episode. It's part of our Patreon Club Fish. So if you want to become a member of that, to hear that, go to patreon.com/clubfish, and there's multiple tiers of various different fun things that you can get when you're a member of our club. Otherwise, just come back next week because we'll be back here with another episode. And thank you as ever to the Fishbusters team. That's Liang Lee, Ethan Ruperelia, and also the wider Fish guys here in the building in Holborn. And we will see you again next week. Goodbye.